The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Georgene Rice Show, where we're sampling a new format for our Fridays. Hope you'll enjoy that. As usual, we're going to start out with some of the day's headlines. That includes the March for Life that took place in Washington, D.C., a new visitor this time around. And also in the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to feature the headlines again at 5 o'clock, and then the interview of the week. This week, we're going to be looking at Cy Gart, the author of The Works of His Hands, A Scientist's Journey from Atheism to Faith. So we'll see how this works out. First, taking a look at some of the headlines from yesterday, the Russians could attack the U.S. and removing President Trump from office is necessary to preserve the integrity of the 2020 election. Well, those were the claims on Wednesday from Democrat Adam Schiff on Wednesday during day two of the president's Senate impeachment trial. Of course, today was day three. We'll get to that later. The lengthy arguments from Schiff and other House Democrats broke little new ground, if any. Trump's lawyers sat by waiting their turn as the president blasted the proceedings from afar, jokingly threatening to face off with the Democrats by coming to sit right in the front row and stare at their corrupt faces, end quote. Now, of course, new information is not what is to be expected. What the House managers are charged with doing is presenting the case that the House made in that they decided to issue articles of impeachment for the president. So it's not designed to provide new information, although people may have thought that might be the case. Well, the challenge before the House impeachment managers was pretty clear. Democrats were given 24 hours over 3 days to prosecute the charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress against the president. They must try to win over not just fidgety senators sitting silently in the chamber, but also the American public that's deeply divided over the president and his impeachment in an election year. Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, sought to keep the stakes high in his argument. He suggested at one point that military aid to Ukraine was essential so the U.S. would not have to fight Russians at home. As one witness put it during our impeachment inquiry, the United States aids Ukraine and her people so that we can fight Russia over there and we don't have to fight Russia here. Now, that's such an extraordinary exaggeration. I won't comment on it now, but anyway, he went on to say, rather than by voters in the 2020 election, saying it was impossible to be sure the 2020 election won't be compromised. He was drawing rebukes from commentators across the political spectrum for his Russia comments. Schiff attracted the most criticism, however, for later arguing that the president must be removed from office by the Senate because voters simply cannot be trusted to do the right thing in 2020. Meanwhile, three American firefighters died in a water tanker plane crash on Thursday while battling wildfires in Australia. New South Wales Premier Gladys confirmed. Rural Fire Service officials said that they had located the plane, a C-130 Hercules, that crashed in the snowy Murano region of New South Wales state. Colson Aviation in the U.S. state of Oregon said in a statement that one of its C-130 Lockheed large air tankers was lost after it left Richmond in New South Wales with retardant for a firebombing mission. It said the accident was extensive, but provided few other details. The victims were not immediately identified. And the Supreme Court appeared closely split during oral arguments Wednesday in a case that potentially has major implications for the school choice movement, as the justices, including Chief Justice John Roberts, who presided over President Trump's impeachment trial the previous night until 2 a.m., sparred with the lawyers and each other. The case, Montana Department of Revenue versus Espinoza, centers around a tax credit scholarship program passed in May of 2015 that gave Montanans up to a $150 credit for donating to private scholarship organizations, helping students pay for their choice of private schools. The state's revenue department made a rule banning those tax credit scholarships from going to religious schools before the state Supreme Court later struck down the entire law. And we learned yesterday and saw it carried out today that the president intended and did to be the first president to address the March for Life in person. We'll talk more about that in the 5 o'clock hour. And the whistleblower was overheard in 2017 discussing with an ally how to remove Trump. Now, is it that whistleblower? A witness Democrats apparently don't want. The impeachment is driving 1,000 GOP candidates to run for the House of Representatives. And the U.S. has imposed visa rules for pregnant women on birth tourism. Union membership falls to record lows of 10.3%. That's down 10% since 1983. And the Trump administration has approved the Keystone Pipeline on U.S. land. White nationalists arrested ahead of the Richmond rally planned to kill gun rights demonstrators to spark a civil war, according to the National Review, didn't quite materialize. And less than half Americans know 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust. Apparently they thought it was just, you know, a few people. And San Antonio's Chick-fil-A fight has cost more than $300,000 so far. Let's see, K. That's more than $1,000, $300 million so far. I don't know why we substitute the zeros for letters, but there you have it. Anyway, immune cells that kill the most cancer has been discovered by accident by a British scientist, and a Chinese city has halted all air, train, and other transportation to contain the spread of the coronavirus, rather, that has killed 17 so far. Well, this week, pro-life champions from around the nation gathered in Washington, D.C. to commemorate the 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized the slaughter of babies in the United States. These warriors work day after day to change laws, to educate about what abortion looks like, and offer help to women in the midst of their crisis pregnancy. As they converge on the 47th year to march to the Supreme Court, and in states all across the country, in fact, in the state of Oregon, that will be on a Saturday, I can't help but imagine what it would look like if the march included the children whose lives were legally snuffed out before they ever took their first breath. How many people would be marching to awaken the nation's conscience? Well, some 60 million. The ground would literally shake as 60 million boys and girls, men and women, took to the streets. Imagine the roar of 60 million voices, the roar that they would make as they cried out for justice. The innocence, rather, would be as old as 47, and every age down to mere seconds old. Even as they made their way past the U.S. Capitol, their numbers would increase as the souls of new victims were added. With an average abortion rate of about 1.6 lives claimed every minute, by the end of the three-hour march and rally, nearly 300 people would join the ranks. Think about that for a moment. Every hour in America, nearly 100 boys and girls are obliterated or ripped out of their frightened mothers' wombs. Kristen Hawkins, who's president of Students for Life, points out that this is a dreadful truth. Since the average preschool class is 21 children, the abortion industry wipes out 112 preschool classrooms every day. Now consider the women. The majority of mothers who have abortions are in their 20s. Still young and impressionable, they are targeted by Planned Parenthood to ply its bloody trade. 79% of all Planned Parenthood abortion chambers are located within 5 miles of a college campus. That's about 5 minutes away. 5 minutes to the death of a baby, 5 minutes to a lifetime of regret for the mother. Any honest counselor will tell you that post-abortive women live with regret. Save for the awesome power of forgiveness and redemption provided through Jesus Christ, a post-abortive woman, a mother, will likely spend her entire life in and out of anguished torment, whether or not it's ever publicly discussed. Thousands of women who have faced the pain head-on, accepted the grace of Christ, and found loving support now march for life each year. They make it their mission to save other mothers from the horror of abortion as they march arm in arm with the spirits of their lost children. Imagine how large the crowd would be if more post-abortive women found the freedom to break through their chains of sorrow in a courageous move to warn those heading to abortion chambers. Their collective voices could save so many other mothers and babies from the lies, from the pain of an abortion. Of course, not all of the displays of hope and remembrance take place in D.C. A March for Life occurs in every state capital. If the children lost in each state could participate, anywhere from hundreds of thousands to millions, depending on the size of the state, would be marching on the austere legislative houses, crying out for the protection of future children. Imagine the streets filled with aborted innocents. The crowds would be larger than any other event that ever filled those streets. No march would have ever been bigger. Not an end to the Civil War, not the celebration of the end of World War I, not the end of World War II. Even without the victims, the largest marches our nation has ever seen are done to end a war on children. The March for Life is truly the world's largest social movement mobilization and speaks to the unwavering resolve of the American pro-life community. The dreadful Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions inspired an entire citizen army to speak truth about the violence of abortion and to serve in love in their communities for those in desperation. Courageous leaders who exude love and boldly proclaim the life-giving message, like Mrs. Hawkins, who speaks as an advocate, spend every day of their lives helping save women and their children. This week, she and others will train nearly 3,000 student leaders in how to expose the lies of Planned Parenthood and reach young women with hope and tangible help. It's a good day in Washington. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show, and as promised, we're going to focus our attention on the lighter side of the news. Here to help me do just that is Jimmy Blend.
Yeah, that's it.
I know you don't really like Jimmy.
Never have.
Yeah, which is why, of course.
You've made a habit of it for the last 24 years or so. Yeah, no, I get it.
I have.
I'll get over it someday.
I don't really even know how to bring this up. I know we're looking at the lighter side of the news, but this is, quite frankly, a sad story. The iconic Planters mascot, Mr. Peanut, dead at 104.
You know, I'm not sure if what's more surprising, that he's finally gone or that he was 104.
Yeah, both are pretty shocking. Mr. Peanut, the iconic mascot of the Planters Peanut Company that was founded in Wilkes Barre in 1906, has died. Planters released a pre-Super Bowl ad on Wednesday in which Mr. Peanut was killed following a crash of his Nutmobile.
We've been in the Nutmobile.
We have. It is with heavy hearts that we confirm that Mr. Peanut has died at 104, a message on Mr. Peanut's Twitter page read. The page is now named The Estate of Mr. Peanut. A meme tweeted by the page, which featured a teardrop falling from Mr. Peanut's famous monocle, noted the lovable character's lifespan, 1916 to 2020. Planner says the full ad, which will include Mr. Peanut's funeral, will air during the third quarter of the Super Bowl on the 2nd of February. I can hardly wait. Wilkes-Barre businessman Tom Greco, an avid collector of Planters and Mr. Peanut memorabilia, said he couldn't believe the company would kill off the face of the franchise. I guess there is some whiz kid marketing person that says Generation X and Generation Y can't relate to Mr. Peanut. The purists will always remember Mr. Peanut for who he was. Italian immigrant Amadeo Abici, along with his friend and business partner Mario Peruzzi, found Planters Peanut Company in Wilkes-Barre in 1906. It was a great day. In those early days, Obici announced that his company was in need of a trademark to represent the growing brand. In 1916, he announced a contest seeking designs. A Virginia schoolboy, a mere lad, won the contest with his drawing of a 9-foot-tall peanut with arms and legs. Later, an unnamed Wilkes-Barre artist added a top hat, monocle, spats, and a cane, giving birth to Mr. Peanut as we know him. Mr. Peanut became a local icon who would go on to become a national and international symbol of the Peanut Company, helping it become a global brand. The business began at 632 South Main Street in Wilkes-Barre. Planters grew from selling peanuts from a small pushcart on Public Square in Wilkes-Barre into one of the most recognized peanut brands in the world. And though production moved to Suffolk, Virginia years later, the Wilkes-Barre property, well, it remained the business world headquarters through 1961. A mural of Mr. Peanut was featured on a, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little choked up, on a part of the building that was torn down years ago.
You can do this. I got faith in you.
Thank you. Thank you. But the facade of the property remains standing. We'll certainly continue to celebrate him. This is the home of Mr. Peanut and Planters Peanuts, Mr. Greco says. Wilkes-Barre City Councilman Tony Brooks, a local historian, doubts we've seen the end of Mr. Peanut. Although if you see how he died, I hope we've seen the end of Mr. Peanut. He is definitely roasted. Planters would be nuts to permanently kill off Mr. Peanut. His birthplace of Wilkes-Barre will certainly mourn, Mr. Brooks said. Seems like a marketing stunt for their Super Bowl commercial. I bet Mr. Peanut will be back in a jiff. You can always hope.
You know, the one saddest part about this is the... The one that the where it's really going to hurt economically.
Yeah.
The monocle industry.
Yeah.
Who's going to be the fashion trend center for monocles going forward?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, without Mr. Peanut, he was kind of the unofficial spokesperson for wearing a monocle in the 2000s.
Well, in fact, on the Facebook page, his memorial, it's a monocle with a little tear. So
yeah.
There you have it. That may be the end of that iconic symbol as well.
But, I mean, he died a hero.
He did.
He did die a hero.
And if you watch the Super Bowl, you'll learn that he was saving others. He gave him his life in the interest of saving his friends.
Yep. That ad, is, I think you can actually find that, like, on YouTube and stuff now. But...
Yeah.
That's the one. There's two beautiful things because we're coming up. I mean, the Super Bowl's next weekend already, which means really over the next week or so, you pretty much could see most of the ads ahead of the game now.
Yeah. It,
those of us who, you know, would watch the game for the ads don't need to put the effort in anymore, because if you can't find it before the game, you can find it on YouTube immediately after. In this particular scenario, my understanding is that this is a pre, you know, the teaser is the death scene. And then I guess the Super Bowl commercial is actually his funeral.
I don't know if I can take it. I'll have to
That's the thing. It's like
really
a funeral.
Steal,
I mean,
myself,
you know,
for that.
I share that so that we can all, as a community, as a worldwide community of peanut lovers, embrace ourselves for the shock.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I think about all the turmoil in the world, this might be the one thing that will bring us all together. We might see members of the House and the Senate once again on the steps of the state capitol singing God Bless America.
I don't see I don't see a, you know, a warm embrace between Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi over
Not so much. Well, the internet was rocked by the tragic and Super Bowl ad-induced death of Mr. Peanut, who served as the monocle-wearing mascot of Planters Peanuts. While Planters killed Mr. Peanut as part of the marketing ploy, the murder got us thinking, writes Kristen Baldwin for EW.com. What other animated food mascots need to be taken behind the shed and put down? Wow.
That's unnecessarily violent.
Yeah,
wow.
Well, the question prompted a long and rather disturbing thread on their Slack chat, but they eventually managed to narrow down their kill list of five primary offenders.
Okay.
You interested?
I'm interested.
Though he no longer rhymes incessantly, Chester Cheetah, this Cheetos spokescat, still wears sunglasses indoors and now speaks with a British accent that he randomly developed later in life. Plus, Chester is just woefully off-brand. Cheetos are a lot of things, delicious, messy, devoid of any nutritional value, but no one has ever equated the dusty orange crunch sticks with cool. What do you think, Chester Cheetah? Should I stay or should I go?
He's harmless.
Annoying
but harmless, and they don't use him quite as much. You know, he's not
That's true.
As present as he once was.
Well, and, you know, maybe Mr. Peanut is a cautionary tale. Don't show up too much or they will off you. What about this one? This hopped-up bunny has been scheming to get his paws on a bowl of fruit-shaped sugar nuggets since 1959. We're talking about the Trix Rabbit. And he's been thwarted by greedy children for 61 straight years. He apparently has learned nothing. Well, put him out of his misery already, General Mills. Should he stay or should he go?
Oh, I don't. I've never liked him. He would be on my list. He'd definitely be on my list.
On the list. Okay. It was always a little disturbing to watch Mr. Peanut shill peanuts for Planters. Why would he want to encourage people to eat members of his own species? But at least Mr. Peanut did not perform actual acts of cannibalism, as these voracious and vicious CGI candies do on a regular basis. I am referring, of course, to the talking M&Ms. Sure, they poked fun at their grotesque eating habits in a 2003 ad, but they continue to devour their candy-coated brothers and sisters to this day. The talking M&Ms, should they stay or should they go?
Disturbing, but overall inoffensive.
Yeah, I kind of like them.
They're usually used cleverly.
Yeah, I like them. Okay, then there's this. Never mind the Honey Smacks resembles dead bugs and occasionally carry salmonella, but their amphibian mascot who wears a T-shirt bearing his own name and a cap turned sideways, he is essentially the serial version of The Simpsons' Poochie the dog, Dig'em Frog. And that's the Honey Smacks spokes frog. Should he stay or should he go?
You know, I mean... I feel like it's not that he's kind of irrelevant these days.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've seen him recently.
No, I don't feel like I have.
I had heard that he was in a nursing home. I could be wrong about that.
That's very possible.
Yeah, I don't really know.
I heard something about drawing a pension, yeah.
And finally, honestly, Ronald, this is a classic it's not you, it's me situation. When you were introduced as a fast food chain's mascot in 1963, consumers knew a lot less about the damaging health effects of fatty and fried foods. So they could, well, feed their kids quarter pounders and filet-o-fish sandwiches guilt-free. Today's moms and dads, however, can't claim such ignorance, and your smiling clown face, and clown faces have fallen out of favor as well, serves as a haunting reminder that every time I give in to my kids' cravings for a quarter pounder, I'm hastening his own death. We're talking, of course, about Ronald McDonald.
See that,
should I stay or should I go?
You know, he's not the worst in that crew in my mind. Hamburglar.
Yeah, when's the last time you saw him? Nursing home.
Exactly, nursing home.
But Ronald McDonald, he's much better than that Burger King
guy.
Burger King guy. Yeah, I would jump off a bridge if he were to approach me.
That new revision Burger King guy thing. And yeah, no, that's highly disturbing and unnecessary on every possible level.
Yeah, it's...
But I think there are other ones in there that they've kind of, glossed over a little bit. I mean, you know, I was always kind of annoyed by the leprechaun and Lucky Charms.
I like Lucky Charms, so I'm willing to put up with it. And the Lucky Charms, delicious.
You know, Snap, Crackle, Pop, they can be a little annoying. That's why it's like the cereal ones don't bother me too much, yet they sort of, kind of top line almost half that list. So I think that I'm going to have to show a lot of them mercy. And I think of all of those, I think it's got to be, I think the Trix Rabbit's actually the one that's got
to
go.
Yeah, I'd be willing to live without that.
He's the one I've seen enough. And the fact of the matter is, over all these decades, no character growth.
Well, I think just in closing this segment, this thought of today's program, we want to give our condolences to the Peanut family. Mr. Peanut was certainly an honored member of our community. We're saddened to hear of his passing. And I think many of us plan to attend the service during Super Bowl. I think it's third quarter, they said, in which, if you're right, the memorial service will be part of that commercial. So rest in peace, Mr. Peanut.
Or pieces. I was going to say pieces because I saw that explosion. It's definitely pieces.
And I'm wondering, once the deed was done, was he crunchy or smooth?
All I know is he was like butter.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show on a relatively fun Friday afternoon. We're winding our way through some of the lighter side of the news, and we're doing something a little different in the 5 o'clock hour. We're going to re-up the headlines and let you know what's going on, and we're also going to share the interview of the week. We'll talk with Cy Gart, the work of his hands, a scientist's journey from atheism to faith. So stay with us and let us know what you think. Well, we were talking in the previous segment about things that are horrifying. Some of them are mascots and marketing icons. But this one, I think, from the vantage point of being in radio, this was very sad. Vultures overrun a Texas radio tower, causing communications headache for the Border Patrol. Vultures overtake a Texas radio tower. Can you imagine?
I am just trying to picture sending our engineering team out to our transmitter site. To get rid of vultures.
Yeah, I mean, there are vultures of other kind that are circling radio stations. But
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Invading vultures have become a safety hazard near the U.S.-Mexico border, where a 320-foot radio tower is located. U.S. Customs and Border Protection is now asking contractors for proposals to get rid of the uninvited birds with netting, according to the reports. The agency owns the radio tower in Kingsville, Texas. About 300 vultures now call home. Wow. They're requesting information about a population of vultures that have built up and are roosting and nesting on the tower structure, on the railings, catwalks, supports, rails, conduit, and so on. Now, what people probably don't know is a radio tower, you have to have access to it. It needs to be free and clear of debris or vultures. And from time to time, you actually have the engineer go out to the tower to make adjustments or to check on things. So you don't really want to approach a tower where there are 300 vultures just waiting for
No, 300
kind of
volts is bad enough. 300
exactly.
vultures is
that just
worse.
Adds insult to injury. Droppings mixed with other moisture are all on the surface and throughout the interior of the tower where workers are in contact with it, as well as on areas below, they said. They broke the story on Friday, saying the vultures will... oh, my. Vultures are disgusting. I'm not even going to repeat what all they do.
No, no, please don't.
There are anecdotes about birds dropping prey from a height of 300 feet, creating a terrifying and dangerous situation for those concerned. Well, they hope the winning bidders for this particular eradication of these disgusting creatures. Oh, my.
We had I wouldn't say similar situation here at the station a few years ago. In fact, Georgine, I don't know if you remember this. There was a time when the pond just outside the our building here had fish in them.
Oh, that's right.
And they were actually goldfish that had really, they were as big as koi, but they're actually goldfish. And some birds discovered them eventually. And I think they underestimated the size of them. And they would start grab one, pull it from the pond, and start flying off. And more than once, I saw them about, I would say a good 100 feet off the ground over the parking lot. And all of a sudden, that fish went flying and, you know, either just missed a car or I think I saw one land on a hood once. I was like, ooh. Okay.
Yeah, a large fish dropped from a great height is no pretty sight.
No, I mean, it would hurt. I'm sure of it, because the fish itself was probably 2-3 pounds at those size, because it was a very, you know, good 9 inches to 12 inches long and fairly thick. A goldfish, given the opportunity to not live in a goldfish bowl, can grow really big, we learned that year, and become really appealing to the
large water birds.
Large water birds. And we had a couple that just lived up on the roof of our building for about 2 months until they had exhausted the supply of the goldfish. But they were not good at keeping those in their mouths, so we had flying fish that summer around the office.
Yeah, and if you come visit us at the station, you'll notice there are no fish in those ponds any longer.
And no birds, so you're good. You're good.
Yeah, no longer going to do that. Okay, the Washington Department of Transportation has sparked something of a debate over whether they have images of Bigfoot. Now, again, we're in the 21st century. You can take virtually any phone that's been made in the last decade or two and take a very clear picture of anything from a great distance. But somehow, when it comes to Bigfoot, nobody can seem to get a clear picture of the creature. We think we have an image of Bigfoot. You look at it, and it looks like it was taken back in 1930. So it's always interesting to me that while you can take a picture of just about anything, anywhere on your phone, we can't seem to get a clear image of that or the, what's the Ogopogo and the... that creature that's supposed to be the Loch Ness monster.
Is it Loch Ness monster? Yeah.
Well, an image of the legendary creature Bigfoot may have been captured on a Washington State Department of Transportation webcam.
Speeding?
Sasquatch spotted. I'm not superstitious, just a little stitious. That's a quote from a Washington State Department of Transportation East Post on Twitter this week. Have you noticed something strange on our Sherman Pass SR-20 webcam before? If you look closely by the tree on the left, there looks to be something, might be Sasquatch. We will leave that up to you. People played along asking for more information or other photos of Sasquatch in response to the post. They do exist, one reader replied. Well, the agency responsible for transportation information east of the Cascade Mountains posted a follow-up tweet on Thursday saying crews made several passes near the area but came up empty. Oh, really? We made it back from Sherman Pass, made several passes, and even stopped at the top of the summit near the camera to see if we could find Sasquatch or any evidence of his or her presence. No such luck, the agency said. When asked for more details about the photo, the transportation agency said its signals sign shop manager knows the truth behind it. There is a story behind it, the agency said. I'll see what I can find out, but he's very tight-lipped. Well, the agency also posted a GIF of Seinfeld character George Costanza saying his famous line, "Just remember, it's not a lie if you believe it." Isn't that the anthem of our age? But that's the subject of a whole other story. Another person did some investigating and replied to the Twitter post after taking a look at the webcam later in the day, saying that, if it's a Bigfoot, it must be a slow one, the user says, because he's still there. Apparently hasn't moved. The camera operates 24 hours a day, and the image updates every 60 minutes, according to the Department of Transportation, Washington State. Well, back in December, scientists and explorers were reportedly on the trail of a legendary creature in the forests of Oregon. With some using thermal cameras as part of the documentary for the Travel Channel, more than 10,000 people in the U.S. have described encounters with Bigfoot over the past 50 years, and not a single one of them has had anything other than a grainy image that you could not really identify as anything reliable.
Maybe it was somebody on their way to go see Star Wars while in costume.
Perhaps that was it.
It's a, you know,
going
through
the
forest. Chewbacca suit. Yeah.
Maybe that was it.
Taking the shortcut.
Now, in the new Star Wars, is that baby, what's that creature?
Oh, Baby Yoda? No. That's the TV series on Disney
Plus.
That
creepy.
You are the only person on the planet that thinks Baby Yoda is creepy, by the way. You know that, right?
Well, I'm perfectly prepared to be the only person because it's creepy.
And actually almost wore the shirts today, so.
Yeah, you wear that with some regularity. And I'm sure it has something to do with my being creeped out by it every time you.
That's just an added bonus.
Yeah, well, several drivers in Washington State, you know, our neighbors to the north, had to be rescued by snowplows after getting trapped in their vehicles on the highway New Year's Eve, according to officials. But the rescue had nothing to do with wintry weather. I mean, it's December, Christmas time, what? Tumbleweeds. They had piled up to 30 feet, blocking State Route 240 and leaving several vehicles trapped, including a semi-truck, according to the Washington State Patrol. The roads was closed in both directions from 6:30 p.m. near West Richland, Washington. Tumbleweed. One trooper shared a photo of the Department of Transportation workers making their way through the pile of tumbleweed in the dark, as some drivers can still be seen in their view. I mean, it's incredible. 30 feet high. Think about your car, you in it. They said the tumbleweeds were piled up 20 to 30 feet high in some places. Strong winds blew the tumbleweeds into the area with berms near the roadway, causing the tumbleweed to create a much larger blockade than normal. Cars that stopped to avoid hitting the tumbleweed quickly got buried. No injuries were reported. Five cars and one 18-wheel semi-truck in total wound up being trapped. You don't hear that sort of thing very often.
No,
if
I mean,
ever.
You know, it's funny, though. Tumbleweeds, I never saw a real one till I was probably about 25, 26.
Yeah? Where were you?
Bend. Actually, Redmond, to be specific. Uh-huh. And I saw a couple go across the parking lot. I'm like, oh, my goodness, they're real. I mean, I knew they were real, but you know, I'd only ever seen them in like movies and cartoons
in real
and
life.
Things.
Yeah,
and it wasn't exaggerated. It was one of those weird things where like the TV and movie portrayals of them just kind of rolling along are accurate.
The tumbling tumbleweed. I would sing the song, but I don't really know how it goes.
That's okay. Maybe people can sing it to themselves during the break.
Okay, we're gonna take a break so you can sing about tumbleweed. You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show, winding our way through some of the lighter news today. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the fun portion of today's program, taking a look at the lighter side of the news. You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show. James Blend is with me in studio as we do wind our way through some of the, lighter side of the news.
I'm just amazed at how busy things were in the state of Washington, as we discovered last segment. Seems like
everything.
Really? Tumbleweeds, Bigfoot, what's next?
Who knows? Vultures?
I suppose we could be talking about Olympia.
Yeah, that could
be. But
The owners of an Australian pizzeria cooked a nearly 340-foot pizza to raise money for firefighters battling the country's bushfire. It's amazing to me what people do to either draw attention to themselves and, you know, find a place in the Guinness Book of World Records or to raise money. In this case, 340-foot pizza to raise money for firefighters battling the ongoing bushfires there. Siblings Pierre and Rosemary Moio, owners of an Italian pizzeria near Sydney, New South Wales, used a conveyor oven on Sunday to cook the 338-foot margherita pizza on the road in Kirrawee. The pizza was then cut into 4,000 slices, served to a crowd of people who gathered to donate to the New South Wales Rural Fire Service. Pierre, one of the siblings, told CNN the aim was to create Australia's longest ever continuous pizza. The world's longest pizza, by the way, measured 6,333 feet long, was cooked in California back in 2017. It may not have broken a world record, but it was an event that certainly helped make a difference in raising much needed funds, Moyo said. He said an estimated 3,000 people turned up for the event, but he didn't have a total yet on the amount of money that was collected. But 3,000 people, 4,000 slices, not bad. I'm sure they earned some coin for that ongoing effort. And then there's this candy maker Mars Wrigley. That doesn't go together. Mars Wrigley, that sounds like an oxymoron, but, you know, they consolidate these days. Set a new Guinness World Record by producing a massive Snickers bar weighing 4,728 pounds. The company said the Snickers bar, unveiled on Thursday at the Mars Wrigley plant in Waco, measures 12 feet long, 24 inches high, 26 inches wide. The candy bar is the equivalent of 43,000 regular-sized Snicker bars. Actually, it's Snickers bars. Guinness confirmed the gargantuan confection met the record-keeping organization's requirements to capture the record for the world's largest chocolate nut bar. The requirements state the bar must be at least 80% chocolate and nuts, and the entire bar must be fit for human consumption. And apparently it was. Mars Wrigley said the giant Snickers bar will be featured in an ad that will premiere during the Super Bowl. Well, there you go. Marketing, Super Bowl. Timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
Well, if you're planning on traveling to Florida, I want to warn you, it's getting a little chilly there.
I've heard that.
And cold weather in Florida brings the chance of iguanas falling from trees unexpectedly.
Are they being dropped by vultures?
No, they're just being dropped. It's chilly with a chance of falling lizards. That's what they say in Florida. Temperatures in South Florida dropped so low on Wednesday morning that forecasters in the National Weather Service office in Miami warned residents to be on guard for falling iguanas, a real hazard. This isn't something we usually forecast, but don't be surprised if you see iguanas falling from the trees tonight as lows drop into the 30s and 40s. That's cold for Miami. The Sunshine State was seeing the coldest temperatures in almost a decade on Wednesday morning, with freeze warnings posted throughout the state, according to the meteorologist. It's so cold in Florida. How cold is it? They're setting record temperatures, and you know they're afraid of the iguanas falling from trees. They don't freeze, they don't die, but they do go into this kind of state of hibernation, and it's really something to see. They just become ice cubes, drop from the sky, and lay there until it warms up. The low temperature stuns the invasive reptiles, but the iguanas won't necessarily die. That means many will wake up as the temperatures rise. One scientist at the National Hurricane Center there in Miami shared a photo of an iguana that appeared to be stunned on the ground. Other photos showed stunned iguanas lying on the ground as well. These green creatures are an invasive species and are not native to the Sunshine State, so they'd probably like to scoop them up and move them on elsewhere. But a stunned iguana lying in the grass in a location in Miami is something to see. They aren't dangerous or aggressive to humans, but they damage seawalls, sidewalks, landscapes, foliage. They can dig lengthy tunnels. The males can grow up to 5 feet long, weigh nearly 20 pounds. Female iguanas lay nearly 80 eggs a year. And South Florida's warm climate is perfect for the prehistoric-looking animals. They're native to Central America, tropical parts of South America, and some Caribbean islands, but not Florida. It's not the first time that residents there have spotted stunned lizards out on the pavement. Temperatures dipped into the 40s in January of 2018, and that resulted in similar photos and videos of lizards who were immobilized by the cold weather, just, you know, hanging around. They're allowed to be kept as pets there in Florida, but not protected by any law except anti-cruelty to animals. They've been in South Florida since the 60s, but their numbers have increased dramatically in recent years, and that's really creating a real problem. Floridians.
Can you imagine it from their perspective, though? Think about it this way. They're, you know, talking to their friends a couple days after this. No. I was in bed, right? And I was kind of cold, so I was reaching for my blanket, and then the lights go out. And then the next thing I know, I can see my bed off in the distance in the sky, but I can't move. It was like the worst dream I've ever had.
Yeah, that's what happened to me, too.
You too. We have the same dream. Whoa.
Well, Spotify, who is apparently a lover of animals, has made playlists and a podcast for dogs to listen to while their owners are absent. After finding that nearly 74% of UK pet owners play music for their animals, Spotify decided, hey, we can do something with that. Well, the Swedish audio streaming business company said, it's kind of a long way of putting it, said they've launched a podcast featuring soothing music, dog-directed praise. I don't even
good
know what that
boy
means. Stories and messages boy of affirmation and reassurance narrated by actors to alleviate stress for dogs who are home alone.
I would imagine that depends on the actor doing the reading. I mean, if it's James Earl Jones, I mean, anybody's going to be like, oh, okay. But if it's like, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, it's like, whoa, okay, whoa, all right.
Yeah, they're chewing stuff. And
I'm nervous.
The playlists aimed at pets offer tracks selected by algorithms to match pets' characteristics, such as energetic or slow. So you'll have Spotify playing whatever suits your pet. They say it found in a survey that 1 in 4 pet owners play music for their pets to listen to for company when they're away from home, with 42% of owners saying that their pets have a favorite type of music. How would you know your pet's favorite type of music? 1/4 of pet owners said that they have even seen their pets dancing to the music, or at least we call what they're doing dancing. So there you have it. If you're looking for something to entertain your pets while you're away, Spotify. And then there's this. It's interesting to me that somebody on the internet in its various forms will decide this is the latest challenge and people just run out and do it. They open up a perfectly sanitary box of ice cream in the store and they lick it. They, do things and try things that wouldn't have occurred to them, but do it because someone issued a challenge. Well, fire investigators in Massachusetts are hoping to help pull the plug on a new viral challenge that may be redefining the word stupid. And by the way, in this age, it's redefined almost on a moment-by-moment basis. It's called the outlet challenge. Participants insert the plug part of the phone charger cord only partway into the outlet, then try to produce a spark by touching a penny to the exposed prongs.
Aye!
Okay, the question comes to mind. Why?
Is this some sort of bizarre social experiment to get the really stupid people in our population off themselves?
I do not know.
Because the challenge, it doesn't seem like something anybody with any modicum of intelligence would try.
But apparently they do. The challenge has been linked to scorching of outlets in Holden and Plymouth, this is in the UK, as well as a fire in Westford Academy, where one student is facing criminal charges. Officials are also warning of the possibility of death by electrocution. Well, there is that. The other issue can be that you do damage to some electrical wiring behind the wall, and fire could be undetected and burning in the walls, endangering everyone that's in the building long before you're aware anything has happened. Oh, my goodness. Well, a photo that was released by the Plymouth Fire Department showed a penny and a phone charger plug singed and fused together after a recent incident. Again, why? The city school superintendent blasted the stunt as an irresponsible act, which is probably why they do it. We are working with the Plymouth Police and Fire Departments to fully understand the scope of this issue and pursue charges to the fullest extent of the law. Something else to consider. Parents are being advised to watch for attempts to participate in the challenge and to have conversations with their children and teens about electrical and fire safety. Wow, the ways we come up with to seek mischief. All right, we're going to take a break. We've got news and traffic coming at the top of the hour. When we return, we'll take a look at some of the day's headlines, so stay with us.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to the second hour of the Georgene Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. James Blind is producing, Clark Hilton engineering today's program, and thanks for making the Georgene Rice Show a part of your afternoon. We're doing a little bit different format today. We're trying it out. We're going to share with you some of the headlines of the day and then the interview of the week. Today we'll hear from Cy Gart, The Works of His Hands, A Scientist's Journey from Atheism to Faith. Once again, the headlines is the third day of President Trump's Senate impeachment trial wrapped up Thursday. Most of the drama was elsewhere, with one witness for the Democrats accusing a Republican senator of defamation and slander after she questioned his patriotism, and implicated him in a scheme to take down Trump from inside the White House. The spat began on Thursday evening on Twitter, when U.S. Senator Marsha Blackburn, a Republican out of Tennessee, quoted the commanding officer of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman as saying that Vindman was a political activist in uniform. Vindman, a National Security Council official, testified during House Democrats' impeachment inquiry last year that Trump's Ukraine dealings left him in a state of shock. Democrats quoted from Vindman's remarks during the Senate trial on Thursday. Vindman has denied knowing the identity of the whistleblower who flagged Trump's fateful July 25th phone call with Ukraine's president. Republicans have questioned that claim because under cross-examination, Vindman apparently admitted to leaking the contents of Trump's call to the whistleblower. As U.S. Representative Adam Schiff, who presided over House Democrats' impeachment inquiry and is the leading impeachment manager at the Senate trial, spoke Thursday and made references to Vindman, Blackburn fired off a series of tweets. It makes sense that Alexander Vindman leaked the July 25th phone call to his friend, a.k.a. the whistleblower, Blackburn tweeted. They both have lots in common, held the same NSC job. Liberals who worked under Obama wanted to take out Trump. Well, Vindman's legal team responded within hours, accusing Blackburn of slandering him with defamatory tweets. Speaking to the Ingram Angle on Thursday, Blackburn doubled down. China's deadly coronavirus has claimed its first life outside the city of Wuhan, the epicenter where the infectious disease began, officials confirmed Thursday as they expanded their unprecedented lockdown, affecting some 25 million people there. The 80-year-old victim died in the province of Hebei near Beijing after visiting relatives in Wuhan for more than 2 months, according to local reports. Nearly 80 people who have been in contact with the victim have been quarantined. The death brings the total number of coronavirus victims to 25, more than half of which occurred in Wuhan. Meanwhile, at least 830 cases of people infected by the disease have been reported worldwide. Chinese officials on Thursday locked down at least six cities: Wuhan, Yizhou, Huanggang, Qibai, Guangjing, Jingjiang, Jingman, and Guangzhou, all in central China's Hubei province, where the illness has been concentrated during the busy Lunar Year travel period. The open-ended lockdowns are unmatched in size, embracing more people than New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. At least two of the FBI's surveillance applications to secretly monitor former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page lacked probable cause. That's according to a newly declassified summary of a Justice Department assessment released on Thursday by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISC. The Department of Justice admission essentially means that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA warrant, authorization to surveil Page when stripped of the FBI's misinformation, did not meet the necessary legal threshold and should never have been issued. A whistleblower who reported government waste, fraud, and abuse gets none of the protections the anti-Trump whistleblower received, according to Real Clear Politics. So this was an extraordinary extension of protection. And the Trump administration is planning action against California over the abortion coverage requirement. A father has asked Elizabeth Warren if he's going to get his money back after paying his daughter for his daughter's education. And a Democrat professor's, Democrat professors outnumber Republicans 9-1 at top colleges. That explains a lot. LGBTQ education is now mandatory in New Jersey schools. Well, the ugliness of identity politics, Miami PD suspends a white officer who begins identifying as black because his profile indicates he does have African-American heritage. And a Tennessee governor has announced fetal heartbeat bill, other abortion restrictions as well. National Review has more. And toxic forever chemicals found in drinking water throughout the United States, USA Today reports, are wreaking havoc with U.S. health. And on this day in history, 1984, Apple Computer began selling its first Macintosh model, which boasts a built-in 9-inch monochrome display, a clock rate of 8 megahertz, and a 128K of RAM. The sale starts 2 days after the company's 1984 commercial airs on CBS during the Super Bowl, the only national airing of the spot on TV. On this day in 1848, James Marshall, a New Jersey native, discovers a gold nugget at Sutter's Mill in Northern California, helping launch the Gold Rush of 1849. And on this day in 1942, the Roberts Commission places much of the blame for America's lack of preparedness for Imperial Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor on Rear Admiral Husband E. Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short, the Navy and Army commanders. And 1965, Winston Churchill dies in London at age 90. The game is played in Pontiac, Michigan, the first cold weather site selected for the NFL's championship game. Along the venue is fully enclosed Pontiac Silver Dome on this day. And in 1985, the Space Shuttle Discovery is launched from Cape Canaveral for the first secret all-military shuttle mission. On this day in history, 1989, confessed serial killer Theodore Bundy is executed in Florida in the electric chair. And retired Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall dies in Bethesda, Maryland at 84 in 1983. 2003, former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge is sworn in as the first secretary of the new Department of Homeland Security. He had served as Homeland Security Advisor until the agency was launched. And finally, on this day in history, 2013, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta announces the lifting of a ban on women serving in combat. Well, President Trump today became the first sitting president to address the annual March for Life rally in Washington, appealing to the pro-life movement with a call to protect the sanctity of life while accusing Democrats of becoming more radical on the issue. The president, who for years was pro-abortion, has since embraced a pro-life position and made clear on Friday that he plans to continue that agenda as he seeks re-election. Underscoring his stance, his administration's hours earlier moved to challenge California over a rule that mandates insurance plans cover elective abortions. It is my profound honor, the president said, to be the first president in history to attend the March for Life. He told the crowd in Washington, unborn children have never had a stronger defender in the White House. Every life brings love into this world. Every child brings joy to a family. Every person is worth protecting. End quote. The president also panned Democrat stance on abortion as extreme and went out of his way to thank the tens of thousands of high school and college students who took long bus rides to be here in our nation's capital. When it comes to abortion, Democrats have embraced the most radical and extreme positions taken and seen in this country for years and decades, and you could even say for centuries, Trump said, accusing many of supporting taxpayer-funded abortion all the way up to and until the moment of birth. While many Democrats have embraced more permissive stances on abortion, with the word rare seemingly disappearing from the safe, legal, and rare slogan coined by former President Bill Clinton, there's still the pro-life Democrats. Last year, for example, Louisiana Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards signed a bill that would prohibit women from having an abortion once a baby's heartbeat is detected in almost all cases. Other Democrats, however, have moved to purge pro-life members of the party and have done so successfully. New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said, and by the way, she's running for president in 2020, said, as a party, we should be 100% pro-choice and it should be non-negotiable. Message received. Party reflects that priority for the most part. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we're going to give you an opportunity to hear the interview of the week. We had an opportunity to talk with Cy Gart, The Works of His Hands, A Scientist's Journey from Atheism to Faith. And we'll hear later about a new U.S. religion census that maps the way the church is changing. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to the final segment of The Georgine Rice Show. Well, the U.S. religion census has mapped the changing of the church and declining denominations. This 2020 project shows shifting complexity of organized religion, as opposed to disorganized religion, I suppose. Well, church historians, sociologists, and statisticians are going county by county, denomination by denomination, group of believers by group of believers, to compile the most complete record of organized religion in the country. The 2020 U.S. Religion Census. Well, the official census conducted by the United States government does not measure religious affiliation. Most data about religion in America comes from polling, but polling has its limits. Excuse me. For every 10 years, the Association of Statisticians of American Religious Bodies counts and maps religious congregations in the U.S. Well, the project is a massive undertaking, as you can imagine. In the year 2010, the organization counted 236 religious groups, with 344,894 congregations and 150,686,156 regular participants, releasing its results in a 762-page book with 31 color maps. Exhausting and, well, relatively exhaustive, if you can put those two things together. Well, in 2020, they're counting again. Southern Baptists and American Baptists, plus National, Progressive, Independent, Fundamental, Full Gospel, Free Will, and Original Free Will Baptists. They're counting Grace Gospel Fellowships and Fellowships of Grace Brethren, 12 types of Lutherans, 30 affiliations of Amish. They're counting churches without buildings, churches that meet in multiple locations, congregations with no denomination, and congregations that belong to more than one denomination. That must be interesting. Well, in the process, coming up with the numbers, the census takers wrestle with the complexity of organized religion. They just want clean stats, but these data, well, obsessively end up mapping denominational decline and transformation, migration, reorganization, and the seemingly endless shifts in the shape of the church. Now, one would hope, and I hope and pray this for the church at large, that the central themes of the scriptures remain the central themes of the church. But according to this particular census, Richard H. Taylor, a retired United Church of Christ minister who was president of this organization from 1998 to 2001, there really is a feeling that maybe denominations have seen their day. They may be reshuffling the cards here in America. Well, two of the biggest trends is the rise of non-denominational Christianity and the weakening of denominations. So it's a rather interesting survey. You can find this. It's the 2020 U.S. Religion Census. There's a link to it on Christianity Today's online page, but you could probably also Google it as well. Again, every 10 years, the Association of Statisticians of American Religious Bodies, or ASARB, counts and maps religious congregations in the U.S., and it does reflect the changing churches and how we associate with one another, whether that's through denominations or in other ways. I know there are a number of non-denominational churches that are loosely affiliated with one another and function and behave as if there was some sort of a denominational connection. But that would be reflected in this U.S. religion census. You might want to check that out. Well, taking a look at the program next week, we're working on a number of things. Among the interviews we'll be working on, Todd Nettleton. He's the author of Fox, Voices of the Martyrs, A.D. 33 to Today. These are such interesting stories. I mean, interesting is such, it's not the right word to apply to those whose lives have been taken from them. They have been martyred for the sake of the gospel. And I make that distinction because there are some faith traditions outside of Christianity in which you pursue martyrdom because that somehow earns you a higher status with the deity. That is not the case with Christianity. If you are martyred, it is not because, at least from a biblical perspective, it is not because that is what you seek in order to gain favor with God. It is what happens when you faithfully follow Jesus, because if they hated him, they will hate you. So anyway, we're going to talk with Todd Nettleton. It's sort of an updated version of Fox's Book of Martyrs, and this one is titled Fox, Voices of the Martyrs, AD 33 to Today. We're also going to talk on, well, I won't even mention the days, but we'll talk with Dr. Darius Daniels. He's the author of Relational Intelligence, The People Skills You Need for the Life of Purpose You Want. Now, we hear about all kinds of EQ, emotional intelligence, IQ, which measures your intellect. Well, this is a relational intelligence, and Dr. Daniels will talk with us about that from his book, Relational Intelligence, The People Skills You Need for the Life of Purpose You Want. We're also going to talk with Jenny Donnelly, author of Still. I'm just going to pause for a moment. That's such a delightful word in our busy and hectic time. Still, Seven Ways to Find Calm in the Chaos. The book is published by Revell, and we'll be talking with Jenny Donnelly this next week, among other authors and guests throughout the week as we seek to provide some edifying content in the midst of our reporting on events that are going on around us as well. I'm so grateful that we are not reliant upon what happens in Salem or in Olympia that our hope is not set on what happens in Washington, D.C. If that were the case, then we of all people should be despairing. And while what happens in these places is important, what happens in City Hall and the county commissioners and all of these places where authority is exercised, ultimately our allegiance is to God. Our hope is in Him. Our future rests in Him. So we can navigate life with all that's swirling around us without despairing. So I'm so grateful for that. And in my conversation with Jenny Donnelly, we'll be reminded of that, but I hope throughout the remainder of the week that will be the case as well. So I hope you can join us. We're going to try this format again. Again, we start with headline news. We'll look at the lighter side of the news, revisit headline news at the top of the second hour, and then share with you the interview of the week. So let us know what you think. You can go to Georgine at kpdq.com and let us know what you think. I want to thank James Blinn for producing, Clark Hilton for engineering, and thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.